Evet.
Mr. Johnson, distinguished guests, Washington and Lee students, ladies and gentlemen. As a part of my introduction, I should like to say something about the format of the rest of this morning's program. Our speaker, Mr. Nixon, has written me as follows. Besides a few brief remarks, I would be glad to try to answer any questions your students may ask, since I find that young people are so keenly aware of the great issues, and I appreciate their sharp questioning. Thus, when Mr. Nixon has finished his formal remarks, he will call for and answer questions from the assembly for a period which, unfortunately for us, because of his heavy schedule, must be brief. In thinking about an appropriate introduction, I, of course, consulted Who's Who, which contains the information known to most of you. Mr. Nixon is a native of California, a graduate of Whittier College and Duke Law School. He served in the United States Navy during World War II. He was a member of the House of Representatives and of the United States Senate, and was elected Vice President of the United States in 1952 and 1956, and ran for the presidency of the United States in 1960. He is also a member of Omicron Delta Kappa, which makes his appearance at this assembly, which emphasizes leadership, additionally appropriate. And I might add, Who's Who also lists Mr. Nixon as a Republican. It's an honor, a real honor, to welcome the Honorable Richard M. Nixon, former Vice President of the United States, to Washington and Lee, and to present him to you.
We just made it.
You must have come pretty fast.
Yeah. We were about 15 minutes late. Thank you. We've got a very lively student body here. Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, thank you very much for a very generous introduction. I just was able to hear it. We were running about 15 minutes late, and I'm certainly very impressed by the size of this audience, by your enthusiastic reception, in spite of the fact that they describe me as a Republican. I, too, want to say that the first opportunity to come to this great institution with its historical background and its educational reputation is one that I've looked forward to, not simply because you have one of the most highly publicized mock conventions in the country. And I didn't plan this weather in order to get ready for New Hampshire, incidentally, either. But I am delighted to come here because I know of the interest of this student body. It's a very great interest in academic matters and political matters. I realize that that the generals are very adequate in sports, but that is not an area that you attempt to, shall we say, be first in all cases. I've been trying to think of what would be the most effective subject to cover for this audience, and I want you to know that I'm not going to talk the full period which is allotted for this particular session because I believe and have found in my previous appearances before university and college audiences that you prefer the question period. So consequently, I will use my opening remarks to set the framework for the questions, but not to limit the questions that will follow. In terms of what you would like to hear me discuss in the opening remarks, I really would have appreciated a little bit more briefing. I tried to find out from some of my friends who have friends in this campus, what were the subjects that you were talking about? What do you talk about when you go to docks and sit around? Shooting already. There we are, right? I think I know what you talk and think about when you're going down the road, but... That's one thing that hasn't changed since I was in school. But I do know this, that one of the problems of one generation communicating with another is the failure that we sometimes have to recognize the changes that have occurred. I know that you have a very distinguished law school here, and I happen to have attended law school, Duke University Law School in North Carolina. And I remember 30-odd years ago when I entered law school in the midst of the Depression, the advice that was given to us by one of the most exciting professors that we had in the law school at that time, who would say anything in order to stimulate interest, and law professors, as you know, have that custom. But in any event, this professor at the very first session of the class said, now, young man, I know that you're all interested to know how to be a success in your profession. I can give you some advice. I would suggest that you marry for money and practice law for love. That was in the Depression. Things have changed now. You live in a seller's market. And because you live in a seller's market, that means not only as far as the law students and others who come out of this institution and the other professions, that you will find that as far as getting a job is concerned and making a living is concerned, that while that still is a preeminent interest for you, it isn't and does not have the obsession that it had for us of another generation who grew up in those Depression years when jobs were scarce and when making a living was the major interest that we had before, because we had to do that before we could do anything else. I recognize that today, despite all of the criticism of the younger generation, for those who, for example, go so far as to become hippies or others who join in protests that maybe the older generation may not approve of, that the new generation is better educated, that it has far more interest in and understanding of the world and of the problems of the United States than the generation of 30 years ago or 20 years ago or even of 10 years ago. And I don't say that just to butter you up. It's a fact. You know it and I know it. And so with all of these matters in our minds, let me suggest that for a few moments, we think of the times in which we live. And I would like to try to answer briefly a question that was put to me when I was walking on the beach down in Florida right after Christmas for a brief holiday by a young student who came up and said that he was attending the University of Pennsylvania. He obviously came from a better than average family in terms of money income was concerned, and he asked me what my reaction was to the rebellion that many of the younger generation were expressing toward the affluence of our society. And I tried to explain in a brief period to him why I thought that the younger generation today had something to live for. That if there was ever a time when a nation and a people had purpose, it was that time for the United States of America. I didn't get it across. There wasn't time. Perhaps I may be able to explain it briefly to you. I suppose Dickens could say today, much more than he said when he wrote it, that this is perhaps the worst of times and the best of times. It's the best of times in ways that we all understand. The United States of America, now passing 200 million in its population, is the richest nation that the world has ever seen. It's the strongest nation that the world has ever seen. In terms of opportunity for its young people, never have young people had greater opportunity for better jobs, more diversity, more chance for income than you have today. And yet we find that this great and powerful nation of ours has problems at home or abroad and abroad which are greater than any we've had in our history, even greater than that great war that divided this nation over 100 years ago. Greater than that great war, not because it did not pose immense moral and other problems, but because the problems today are more complex, more difficult of simple solutions. Look at the situation abroad. For the first time in our history, the President of the United States is unable to travel to any major country abroad without fear of a hostile demonstration. Look at the situation at home. For the first time in our history since the Civil War, the President of the United States has difficulty in traveling to any major city in the United States without fear of a hostile demonstration. Despite our great wealth, we have had to resort to measures in terms of control of our travel and our expenditures abroad and our investments abroad that the United States has never had to resort to before. These are some of the minus factors. And so when we look at the United States, we can see that we're living in a time which has very great promise, but also in a time which presents very great problems. Let's look at it in terms of the possibilities for peace. Let's leave out the war in Vietnam for a moment. I'm sure that you're going to cover that in the question period, and I will try to have an answer then. But looking beyond Vietnam and looking at the world and the problems that we have in the world that may not even be related to Vietnam, we find that the United States, at this point in time, has troubles in all areas of the world, in Africa and Asia and Latin America, that are not subject to solution by the old institutions, institutions that were set up 20 years ago, NATO, for example, that were adequate and necessary for that period then, but that no longer are adequate for the problems that we have today. Let's look at the situation in terms of the great struggle between the communist world and the free world. Here what we find is that the Soviet Union has just celebrated its 50th anniversary of the coming to power of the Soviet in Russia. And it was a very impressive celebration, impressive in terms of the progress that had been made militarily and economically and scientifically in that country in 50 years. True, that progress was made at very great cost in human terms, and yet that progress has to be admitted if we're going to be objective about our role in the world. But when we look at the Soviet Union and the communist world more closely, we find that they too have troubles. The Soviet Union and China split in an irreconcilable, perhaps, struggle, at least irreconcilable for the foreseeable future, between two great giants trying to determine which will be the leader in a system which will tolerate only one leader. We find that Eastern Europe is turning west. We find that even within the Soviet Union, they have had to turn away from the Marxist concepts of enforced equality and turn to the incentive system of capitalism in order to get the progress economically, which will keep them in a position of competition with our world. And we find also one significant weakness in their system. We mentioned the progress that has been made militarily and economically and scientifically. And yet, in the area where they're supposed to be the strongest, in the field of ideas, there they are the weakest. Because in 50 years, despite the most certainly expensive and widespread propaganda effort ever launched in the history of nations, not one major country in the world has voluntarily voted for a communist system. And whether it's Africa or Latin America or Asia, the underdeveloped nations that are supposed to have been the major targets, we find that in the foreseeable future, it does not appear that that kind of victory at the ballot box will be won. It is significant to note, for example, that the traffic is all one way. With all of the criticism we hear of the United States, with all the criticism we hear of the free world, the traffic is from east to west rather than the other way. And so with all of these factors in mind, we now come to the heart of the problem, the role that the United States can play. What we can do if we are going to fulfill what I believe is our destiny to preserve peace and freedom in the world for the last third of this century. I could describe that role solely in military terms. I believe that it is vitally essential for us to recognize that one of the reasons we have avoided a world war in the past 20 years since World War II is because we have had superiority militarily over those whose objective in the world is victory, whereas our objective in the world is peace. And I could point out that I completely disagree with those who believe that the United States at this point in time can allow that advantage militarily to be dissipated, because equality would be a safe policy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and the communist world, provided their objective was the same as ours. But let the time never come in a confrontation, whether it's in Cuba or the Mideast, when those who seek peace, and that means the United States, do not have the advantage over those who seek victory, because that is the major guarantee of the peace which we have in our hands. I could point out to you the tremendous significance in the broad sense of the war in Vietnam, that when we consider the fact that whether it's communist China and the Soviet Union, who have grave differences on many other points, we find that nevertheless there is one area that they agree on, and that is that they believe that it is their mission in the world to expand communist system, and they act on that belief. And that is the one thing they agree on with regard to Vietnam. How do they expand the communist system? They cannot and will not risk nuclear war unless they have an advantage, and we can avoid that. They cannot win, as we've already demonstrated, through exporting their ideas, because they've tried it for 50 years and they have failed. And so there is left to them one device, a very effective device, the device of exporting and supporting a revolution. And when you take away all of the collateral issues, that's what Vietnam is about. It's an attempt to export and support a revolution, to impose by conquest, through going under a border rather than by the traditional means of going over a border, a system on South Vietnam that the people of that country have not voluntarily chosen. If that particular device succeeds there, it will be tried elsewhere. That is why it is essential, as we talk in terms of how that war is to be ended, it must be ended on a basis that does not reward aggression. Because if aggression is rewarded, if conquest by exporting revolution succeeds there, the hardliners in Peking and the hardliners in the Soviet Union, those who may be in a minority at the present time, will have the impetus and the encouragement to try it again. And the chances for more Vietnams has greatly increased. And so, as we look at the world then, I believe that we can come to one final conclusion. And that final conclusion is that it is a period, looking down through the foreseeable future, in which the chances of world conflict are great, but in which the opportunities of progress such as we have never experienced in the history of the world are greater still. Because for the first time in the history of man, due to scientific advantages, due to areas that you know about far more than I do because your education has followed mine, we can wage a winning war against poverty all over the world. Malthus predictions no longer, they were not valid then, and they are completely invalid and irrelevant today. We can wage a winning war against disease in most areas, and we can wage a winning war against hatred and prejudice. It can be done, provided we have the leadership which must come from all peoples of the world, but in which the United States plays a particularly significant role. And that brings me to my last point. What is the role of the United States? How important it is? I mentioned the fact that the President of the United States would find difficulty in traveling to any major country without fear of hostile demonstrations. I could also mention the fact that we have troubles in all countries of the world, and that you can go to almost any of these countries and find critics of the United States, at least those who speak out, in far greater numbers than you find those that will defend the United States. And yet, let's bear one point in mind. I think it was well illustrated by a statement that was made by General Romulo when he was reporting on a local politician in the Philippines who was running for office and who was somewhat of a demagogue. And the local politician said that his policy was this: give the Americans hell, but don't drive them away. What does he mean by that? What would somebody in Latin America mean by that if he said it, and he well might say it, the revolutionary type, or in Asia? Very simply this: the United States, because of its responsibility, is the subject of criticism. But if at this point in time we were to take the United States of America and lift it bodily out of the world, the rest of the world, the free world, will be living in terror. Because let's never forget that except for the power of the United States of America, not one nation in the world today could afford the luxury of neutrality. This is our mission, then. It is one that we did not seek. It is one that many Americans would not prefer. But in the last third of this century, whether peace and freedom survive depends upon the quality of leadership in the United States. Not only our leadership in diplomacy, but our leadership at home. Politics as usual is not enough for America today. Diplomacy as usual is not enough for the world today. We need new leadership. We need new ideas. Leadership and ideas that come from the new generation. And when I am asked, as I often am, about whether young people should become involved in politics, my answer, of course, is always in the affirmative. I'm not suggesting that all of you can run for office. I'm not suggesting that all of you can win if you run for office. I'm not suggesting you can all be president. I found that out. But I do suggest this, that when the year 2000 rolls around, and when those in this room in that year, celebrating a new year that comes only once in 1,000 years, will be the same age that I am today, when you look back over those 33 years, you will have missed something if you did not have the extra dimension of getting into a cause bigger than yourself at some point and some time. America needs the vision, the dissent, the constructive action that this generation can provide for it in the years ahead. And I hope if my appearance here does nothing more, it may inspire a few of you to become interested in politics as a vocation, and all of you to be interested in politics as an avocation in the years ahead. Thank you.
At this time, Mr. Nixon would invite any questions from the floor that you might have.
you. I... Well, let me see if I understand the question. And I that is not a facetious remark, at least not intended to be, but we are dealing here with a very, very complex question. It is very difficult to separate method from commitment, to begin with. As we all know, and this, of course, is the great tragedy of totalitarian or fascist governments, is that, and their great weakness and their great vulnerability, they accept the doctrine that the means justify the ends. And whenever you accept that doctrine, the means become the end. Let's talk about Vietnam for just a moment. I can have disagreement, and I do have disagreement, with the way that war has been conducted. I, for example, might believe that the policy of gradualism and the employment of our air power has never been successful in a military venture, and I think we have wasted our air and sea and land power in the conduct of that war. I believe, for example, that the United States has been most ineffective in terms of learning from the lesson of Korea and of failing to train until very recently on an adequate basis the South Vietnamese so that they could take over the major share of protecting their country against guerrillas. I believe, for example, that the United States has failed to recognize as much as it should that this is a war that is more than military and far more than military in its character, that what is involved here is a war that does not involve territory and not body counts, but what is involved here is winning the people. I could also disagree with the administration's failure to use its economic and diplomatic leverage on the Soviet Union and for adopting a schizophrenic policy vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, whereby we allow them to have economic and diplomatic detente in Europe and at the same time turn the other way when they stir up trouble as they did in the Mideast, and they were responsible for what happened there and are responsible for the continuing buildup. And when they are the major provider of arms for Vietnam, the present time for North Vietnam. And on the other side of the coin, although I don't share these views, I suppose that some would argue about the conduct of the war, whether we should bomb or should not, and the like. But cutting away all of these factors about how I would disagree with the conduct of the war by the Johnson administration, as I see it, we must recognize that this war, one of the most costly war in our history, and in one sense, the most costly war, in the sense that cannot be measured in men or money, and that is the deep division in the United States, I believe that this war is not just about Vietnam. If it were, then peace at any price might be an objective we could accept. I believe that what is involved in Vietnam, as I tried to outline in my remarks, is a test case as to whether conquest by exporting and supporting a revolution is to succeed. Now, true, there are elements of civil war involved as well. There are other elements that are involved. But in the final analysis, in the event that this war is ended on a basis that will be interpreted as a reward for the communist aggressors, it will bring peace now and bring a bigger war later. And so I say, let's end the war, but let's end it on a basis that will bring home the 20 and 21 and 22-year-old boys that are out there now and not have the 13 and 14 and 15-year-olds out fighting another one 4 or 5 years from now. This is an objective I think I think an overall commitment we should support. Yes,
I'm quite familiar with the history, too.